Hello and welcome to a response a day for the 20th of Iyar. I start by thanking the OU and Rabbi Jacob Bromowitz and David Hochhauser for helping us put the shiurim online and so that we can have an opportunity to learn together. Today we're going to see a response of Ramosha Feinstein's. It's from Shut Igrot Moshe Kochim Vitaros Chelik Bet, response number one. So there, apparently, I don't remember it from my printed volumes of Igrot Moshe, but Moshe sometimes got into issues of Kochim Vitaros, which are not practical halacha. There are issues of how the Beit HaMikdash was structured, how the temple was built, what our conduct in the Beit HaMikdash would have been with various sacrifices, what our conduct with various rules of purity and impurity. There are some issues of Tarot that are today practical halacha as well, but when you talk about Kochim and Tarot, you generally mean the versions of Tarot, of issues of ritual purity and impurity, that are relevant mostly to attending at a Beit HaMikdash, when one can and cannot, what makes things valid and invalid by virtue of becoming ritually impure. In any case, on the 20th of Iyar of Tafshin Chaf Zayin of 1967, so this is May 30th of 1967, this is really one of the things that attracted me to this tshuva, even though it's in some sense much more theoretical than other tshuvot that we tend to see, because these are issues that will only become fully practical once we have a binyan Beit HaMikdash again, once we have a rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, God willing, b'mehirah v'yameinu, speedily in our times. It was interesting to me to watch that on the 20th of Iyar of Tafshin Chaf Zayin, on May 30th, 1967, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes a letter, or tshuva, responsum, to another fellow, who we'll get to in a second, about issues of what the Beit HaMikdash would look like. Now, while it's true that on May 30th, 1967, world events were such that war in the Middle East didn't look non-imminent. There were those who would have told you there might be war in the Middle East, that it's a time of danger, and there were issues and there were concerns and things like that. I don't think that anybody consciously would have predicted the kind of victory the Israelis ended up having, the kind of salvation that Hashem ended up bringing to the Jewish people in terms of reconquering and taking over Har HaBayit, even though they eventually ceded it right back to the Vakf, whatever that discussion for another time. But it's interesting to watch Rav Moshe Feinstein, for whatever reasons, he doesn't explain why he chose today to do it, talking about issues of rebuilding Beit HaMikdash so close to a time when the Jewish people reconquered that place such that theoretically they could rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. The letter is written to a Rabbi Yehuda Leib HaKohen, who's not identified any further in the letter, I think because Rav Moshe Feinstein knew him personally, so there was no need to, but he mentions his book Halichot Yehuda that had just been published. So I didn't know who that was and looked it up, and I almost got the wrong guy. I forget who I almost got. And then I found a website called Tovia Preschel in a Google search, toviapreschel.com, toviapreschel.com. And he was apparently from the website. The opening page of that website has a biography of him. He lived from Tafresh Pei Bet from 1922 till Tafshin Ayin Dalet till Tevet of 2013? It should be 2014, I think. Oh, of Tevet, till late 2013. And he seems to have been a Haredi scholar, meaning a relatively good scholar from the scholarly perspective and a bibliophile and all those things, but somebody who identified in the Haredi world. In any case, in 1972, he wrote in Hatzofeh, which is interesting because it's a Mizrahi paper, but he wrote in Hatzofeh a sort of introduction to Rav Yehuda Leib Kagan and his Sefer Halichot Yehuda. He was a Rebbe at RGJ. He was an old European Rav who had come from there, and it was a big Talmud Chacham, but apparently wasn't very well known, and another thing, Sefer Halichot Yehuda didn't become very, very well known, but he was somebody who people who were in the know, as it were, respected. So Rav Moshe Feinstein clearly respects him. He gets his Sefer HaKuntresim al Rambam Hilchos Beis Bechira. He says, I'm going to talk about, I got your book, and I'm going to talk about the comments you made about the beginning of the Rambam's discussions of how to build and how to conduct the Beit HaMikdash, Hilchot Beit HaBechira, the laws of the Rambam calls the select house, HaBechira, the chosen house. We call it the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. And he has some words of encouragement at the beginning of the letter, which I think are interesting to read and to think about. He says, I tell you, you know, Yeshka, you're doing well and a good job and well done, because you're doing a great thing in producing to the world things that B'nai Torah, Torah scholars basically, will enjoy on matters that really very few people deal with them. So that to me is a sign that Rav Moshe Feinstein is recognizing, and maybe this Yehuda Leib Kagan recognized, that it's a kind of a safer on a topic that very few people are really dealing with, and therefore its audience is tremendously limited. So that's, like, to me, that's always a question. When you're producing a sefer, should you produce it on a topic that's tremendously limited, but you'll enjoy writing it, and the people who in the know might get something out of it? That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying. Congratulations, you're doing a wonderful thing. So that's what this Yehuda Leib Kagan seems to have done. He produced a sefer, seems to have been a good sefer that Rav Moshe Feinstein enjoyed, and he is going to respond to several of the points within the sefer about Hilchot Beit HaBechira, about the building of the Beit HaMikdash. And it is, as we've seen before, an expression of his appreciation of the effort that he's responding. Meaning that is one of the ways the Torah scholars express their appreciation and their respect and admiration, is that they read your work and they respond to it. Even if they respond to it in a way that they disagree, but the response, and here I think it's going to be largely agreement or explanation, but the response is the expression of their approbation of the work. So in the first chapter of Hilchot Beit HaBechira, that's what we're going to be discussing. This is the first chapter of Hilchot Beit HaBechira. First chapter of Hilchot Beit HaBechira, Halacha Zayin, the Rambam had written that in the Azara, so to remember the structure of the Beit HaMikdash in very loose terms, there was steps up to the Beit HaMikdash area itself, and then there was an area called the Chel where people could go. Within the walls of the Beit HaMikdash, there was an Ezrat Nashim, where everybody could walk. Then further in or closer to the area of the Mikdash, the Azara, the courtyard of the Mikdash itself, there was an Ezra Yisrael. There was a place where only male Jews could go, and Kohanim, right, and Leviim, only men basically could go. Beyond that, there was an Ezra Kohanim. There was an area that only Kohanim could go. And then beyond that, you had the Mizbeach, you had the altar, and beyond that, you had an area between the altar and the structure of the Beit HaMikdash, the actual building. The actual building had an ulam, it had an opening area, then a kodesh, then a room, which was the holy, and in the holy you had the shulchan, the show table, and the menorah, and the mizbach hazahav, and you had the mizbach haketorah. You had the altar on which was put mostly incense, and then some blood from some korbanot, and then you had the inner room, which was the kodesh kodeshim, the holy of holies, with the aron kodesh. So the Rambam writes that they would make givulin, they would make boundaries, they would make borders at the end of each kind of an area. So you'd say ad kan li Yisrael, at the end of the Yisrael, at the end of the place where all male Jews could go, but they couldn't go further, then you would put a border of some sort there. We're going to see later, it's probably Rosh HaPispisin. Rosh HaPispisin, you would have out coming out of the walls on the sides of the courtyard, had beams. So the heads of those beams would signify, here's the border, don't go beyond those. And then Ad Kan the Kohanim, and until here, the Kohanim can go, meaning it sounds like it means, until here is the Ezrat Kohanim, even though Kohanim for other purposes can go beyond there, so we'll get to that. So the Kesef Mishnah sources that in the second chapter of Midot, in the sixth Mishnah, where it says, V'roshei pispisin mavdilin, this is what the Mishnah says, that there were these heads of beams, the sticking out of the walls, mavdilin bin Ezra Yisrael, Ezra Kohanim, between the place where ordinary Jews were allowed to go and where only Kohanim were allowed to go. So this Rabbi Yehuda Leib Kagan had raised the question that there in the Mishnah, Rabbi Ezra ben Yaakov held, and we seem to hold this way, Halacha Shaita, Ezrat Kohanim Gavoa Shte Amot Umechza. He says that the Ezrat Kohanim was 2.5 Amot higher than the Ezrat Yisrael. You went up. There was some steps, but you went up, and that and those steps should have been, suggested Rabbi Yehuda Leib Kagan, should have been the Heker. Meaning, if I'm an ordinary Jew, or I'm a Levi, but I'm not allowed to go into the Ezrat Kohanim, and I'm looking for where I can or can't go, what do I need these Rosh HaPispisin to be looking for the heads of the beams? I've got the steps telling me where to go. And since the Rabbi Pasul, like Rabbi Ben Yaakov, so why would he say you'd have to be Asu Gvulin? And he says, the Chazon Ish raised that same question, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says, the Chazon Ish's understanding then of that Rambam was, when the Rambam said Osin Gvulin, he understood it differently than the Kesef Mishnah. Because Mishnah says that its source is Midot, which says, the Mishnah Midot, which says you put these Rosh HaPispisin, the heads of the beams coming out of the walls. The Chazon Ish understood it to mean, no, it just means you make borders, you make boundaries that people know. The Azara is split into areas of different Kedusha, of different sanctity, of different populations who are allowed to enter to various places. So Rosh Hashanah says that's dochak. It's dochak because when the Rambam says gvulin, it sounds like there's some actual marker. And the Chazon Ish is saying it's not an actual marker, it's just a knowledge that there's different levels of sanctity. And as I'm reading it, I just think it's interesting to watch. We've seen others question the Chazon Ish. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was 35 years young, the Chazon Ish would question the Chazon Ish sometimes, and so did the Tzitzit Ezra, who was even younger than that. But Rav Moshe Feinstein is only 20 years younger than the Chazon Ish, so it's really so much closer, and it changes your experience of a great Torah scholar if you're in their time than what happens once they leave the world and they become, you know, or once they're much a generation, a full generation older than you, or two generations older than you, then they're image changes over time. So I thought that was to watch Rosh Chodesh. It's Dochuk. He says, because it doesn't sound like Gevulin would mean that you just know where the differences are. It's especially difficult, he says, because when we say that you make different levels of sanctity, which is what the Chazon Ish had said, so the other example we have of that, says Rav Moshe, is when you make a Kedusha for Kedusha at Ha'ir, when you sanctify the city of Yerushalayim, as they did in the original time that they sanctified, or you sanctify the Azar, the courtyard. So the Gemara in Shavuot on Daf Ted Vav tells us that these need to be sanctified. Yerushalayim was sanctified with Lachmei Toda, with a sacrifice, a thanksgiving offering, which included Lachamim bread, V'Hazara B'Shiyari Mincha, and the Azar was sanctified by offering Shiyari Mincha, leftovers of the Mincha. But other Kedushas, it sounds like, those are big levels of Kedusha, but it sounds like, says Rav Moshe, that other forms of Kedusha happen on their own, and we don't know of such a thing as making a Kedusha. That's what the Chazon Ish seemed to understand it to be. That when the Rambam said, you put Gevulin, you put borders between the places, the Chazon Ish seems to have meant that you identify them as sanctified, and you say, this one is Ezrat Yisrael, this one is Ezrat Kohanim, this is where the Kohanim go, this is where the Yisraelim go, etc. So, but Rav Moshe says, I don't know of such a thing, we don't know of such a ceremony that requires such a thing. Whereas when the Rambam says Osin, it sounds like it's a requirement. So therefore, he says, I don't understand where the Chazon Ish would have gotten that. It seems to me that that's a problem. That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. And therefore, he thinks that no, you have the Pispisin, and you need them even for Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Remember, the Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov had held that there are steps going up. There's 2.5 amot going from the Ezra Yisrael to the Ezra Kohanim, and there are steps going up there, so why would you need Pispisin? So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, I think you need the Pispisin because the fact of steps doesn't tell you necessarily that it's a different Kedusha from what was below it. Because in the Chel, which is outside the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, there were 12 ma'alot to go up to the Ezrat Nashim, and that was all one Kedusha. The people who were allowed to go into the Chel are also allowed to go into the Kedusha. And then from the Ezrat Nashim is the area, there's a wall separating, but outside of the Azara of the Beit HaMikdash itself, outside the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash itself, where you'd have the Mizbeach, you'd have the altar, and you'd have the sacrifice, and you'd have Kohanim, and you'd have Levim, you'd have all that stuff. Outside of that, you had an open area, which had other parts and other aspects of Beit HaMikdash to it, and places where you could get your animals, and you could check your animals, and all sorts of things. And a Nazir would have there was a fire there to burn some of the hair of all sorts of things that you would, to burn various sorts of things. So from the Ezrat Nashim, there were 15 steps up to the Ezrat Yisrael, or 15 steps up to the place where male Jews were allowed to stand and allowed to be, and the Kedusha of the Ezrat Nashim, the Kedusha of the open area, wherever it is allowed to go, it's called the Ezrat Nashim because women are allowed to go there as well, so the Kedusha of that open area extended until the end of the steps. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, so in the Ezrat Yisrael, going to the Ezrat Kohanim, it's the other way around. The Kedusha only goes until the steps start. Once the steps start, that's already Ezrat Kohanim. And therefore, what shows is the steps aren't a sign of anything, because you have steps that it's all one Kedusha all the way through, from below the steps to above the steps and beyond, like from the Chel to the Ezrat Nashim. Then you have steps where the Kedusha, the sanctity, extends from the lower area to the top of the steps. So, and then you have areas where the Kedusha ends only until the bottom of the steps. So if you held the ma'alot as a siman, if you use the steps as a sign of where the Kedusha goes, you would make a mistake, and you would think that it's like the previous stuff that we've spoken about. And therefore, you would need Rashi Pispisin, you would need the heads of the beams at the end to tell you, nope, those steps are out of bounds for ordinary Yisraeli. That's good so far. But then the Rambam also requires a boundary, seemingly Rashi Pispisin again, beams extending out after the 11 amot, the 11 amot of the Ezrat Kohanim. So the 11 amot of the Ezrat Kohanim is, so remember, an amah is about 1.5 feet to 2 feet, depending on which opinion in the Achronim you hold for the length of an amah. I think we mostly assume that it's about 1.5 feet, but Rav Moshe finds it actually, the tshuva about mechitza held that it's like a little over 20 inches, and some hold that it's even bigger, 24 inches. So an 11 amot would be somewhere around 16 and a half feet to 22 feet, somewhere around there. So that was the breadth of the Ezrat Kohanim. And at the end of that, the Rambam seems to require Gvulin as well. Problem with that is that after the Ezrat Kohanim, what you have is you have the Mizbeach, you have the altar, which is sort of basically in the middle, a little to the north of the Azara, but basically in the middle of the Azara, basically towards, if you're walking in the gate from the Azara. I have a picture in my head, and you're facing east, as we do. So a bunch of Amot away from you is the actual structure of the Beit HaMikdash. Between you entering the gate that gets in, and the actual structure was the Mizbeach. Although the Mizbeach was a little displaced to the north, you'd have the ramp up to the Mizbeach, and then the Mizbeach there, in basically in the middle of that area. So there's the area of the Ezra Yisrael, and the area of 2.5 Amot steps, area of the Ezra Kohanim, and then you have the Mizbeach. Now, here's the issue, though. Where the Mizbeach is, and the Mizbeach is, I forget its dimension, but let's say the Mizbeach is 10 feet wide. I think it's a little more than that. I'm just blanking now, but it's not our point. My point is only that it's whatever number of feet wide it is, it doesn't extend the whole length. What I'm calling breadth is really the length of the Azara. It doesn't extend the whole width of the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash. So there's an area north of the Mizbeach that's open. That's where you had a lot of sacrifices being offered. And there's an area south of the Mizbeach where you could have Kachim Kalim, you could have lesser sacrifices or sacrifices of lesser Kedusha offered there, but you had things going on. So that space was not, Rav Moshe Feinstein points out, a separate area of sanctity as far as we know. Meaning we call it the Ezra Kohanim because a lot of Kohanim could gather there, but those same Kohanim, if they had some reason to go north of the Mizbeach or south of the Mizbeach or even on the Mizbeach, would all do that. So why would the Rambam say that you need Rosh Pispis and you need some kind of marker of demarcation between the Ezra Kohanim, where Kohanim can gather, and the area of the Mizbeach, which seems to be all the same kind of an area in terms of its sanctity. Where there is a difference of sanctity is once you get onto the other side of the Mizbeach, right, if you're entering from the west where the gate was, and you walk through the Ezra Yisrael, up the steps, through the Ezra Kohanim, and then around the Mizbeach somehow, once you're beyond the Mizbeach, there is no Mizbeach to your right or to your left, depending where you're standing, right, to your north or if you're standing to the north of Mizbeach, so to your south or to your north, you're moved on with that. You moved further east, and you are now east of the Mizbeach, so you're between the Mizbeach and the opening of the Beit HaMikdash itself, of the actual structure, the actual building of the Beit HaMikdash. So that's a new level of sanctity in Halacha. Mishnah Kelim that Rosh Feinstein refers us to says that in that area, Balei Mumin, so Kohanim, who have a physical, people always say blemish, right? A mum is a blemish, but I think if you look in the list of mumim, you see that many of them aren't quite blemishes. I think they're differences. It's a whole topic of its own, but I prefer to say balei mumim, people with physical differences. What I mean, and I don't mean to be apologetic, like, you know, oh, let's not call a handicap, let's call it a difference. I mean that some of the mumim really don't qualify me as any kind of a handicap or whatever. You know, let's say somebody has one eye, a unibrow. So that seems to be a mum in halacha, and yet I don't think any of us would think of it as a deep handicap of any sort. So I think that that's an important issue within the definition of Balei Mumin, but also Pruei Rosh, people don't have a head covering. They can't go into that area. So the Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying, so that's really a different area. So there I would understand it. So he says, no, but since the Ezra Kohanim is only called those 11 Amot, the other area is not called Ezra Kohanim because there's a Mizbeach there. So there's no reason to call it an Ezra Kohanim because it's different physically, even though it's not different in Kedusha. So therefore he suggests that that's why Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Rambam held, and the Rambam understood from the Mishnah and Midot that you need a heker, you need some kind of a way to differentiate the two areas just because they're different areas, even though they don't have a different halakhic perspective. Even though it's not in the Mishnah, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, even though it's not in the Mishnah, and even though no commentators mention it, that's how he understands it. So that's an example of, and that's why I noted it in my notes, I have it in italics, it's an example of Rav Moshe Feinstein being very comfortable saying things that nobody has said before because his logic tells him this is the only answer. To me, that's an interesting question to think about, and I'm not one to challenge Rav Moshe Feinstein on anything, but it's an interesting thing to think about. If our logic says there's no other answer, does that mean that whatever answer we come up with is true? So it reminds me, and I've said this in varying contexts many, many times, Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle put in the mouth of Sherlock Holmes the rule that eliminate the impossible, and whatever's left, however plausible, must be the truth, which is a fine logical principle, but it relies on our ability to say we know how to eliminate the impossible. So very often, if we eliminate something as impossible, and it's really the answer, we've defeated ourselves because whatever is left will not be true because we eliminated something as impossible, which was really actually the possible truth. I just recently read a book which was talking about some issues in logic and in theory and whatever and said, you know, nobody believes in a soul, so therefore blah, 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 blah. So once you eliminate belief in a soul, considering that I believe that there is a soul, and I understand, and you know, many, many religious traditions have spoken about a soul, you've just made it impossible for yourself to find the truth. So here too, I find that Rav Moshe Feinstein sometimes says, like here, says, even though nobody said this before, even though I haven't seen it anywhere, this is the only possibility, so it must be the truth. So I find that a proposition. I think it could often work, and it could be that many, many times Rav Moshe Feinstein therefore comes with Kiddushim, which everybody comes to agree, yeah, that must be the truth, because we see it and we're convinced by it, and yeah, it makes sense. So it might be that that then becomes the way traditional Orthodox Judaism understands the Torah. But I think that sometimes you can eliminate things. You can say, well, and it's not like I have a competitive answer here. I'm just saying, I think it's an interesting thing to watch when we assume what must or must not be the truth. Now, there was a possibility for why you could have said that there's a different area, because the Rashi era elsewhere seems to hold that it's preferable even for Kochim Kalim. So Kochim, there are different kinds of korbanot. Some korbanot are considered or called Kochim Chamurim, or, you know, of serious sanctity, whatever those words mean. And Kochim Kalim are those of lighter sanctity, whatever those words mean. But one of the differences between them is that Kochim Kadashim, that's what it's called, not Kochim Chamurim, Kochim Kadashim, the sanctified sacrifices are only allowed to be slaughtered in the north of the Azara, the north of the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, and Kochim Kalim can be slaughtered Bechol Makom Azara, in any place in the Azara, in the courtyard. There's a Rashi, however, that seems to imply that every place in the courtyard still means that it's better to do it in parallel to the Beit HaMikdash in Yoma, that it's still better to do it in parallel to the Mizbeach. And when we say Tzafon, and we say you only offer Kochei Kadashim, when you only sacrifice Kochei Kadashim, slaughter them in the north of the Azara, we don't mean anywhere in the north, we mean Lachatkila should be north of the Mizbeach itself, in that area. So then, that would be a good reason for the Rambam to hold that you need Pispisi, you need beams coming out, because we tell you where the best place is, the Lachatkila place is, the appropriate place is to sacrifice Kochim. But the Rambam doesn't actually mention that halacha. Now, here again, so if the Rambam doesn't mention it, that means he didn't hold of it, or he didn't mention it, a whole question of itself. In any case, Moshe Feinstein's basic answer is that he thinks that the Rambam says you have the borders there because of the difference in names. That's enough to justify putting in this position. So that's his discussion of that's the first discussion that he has of the topic of the issue of Rosh Pispisit, of whether Rabbi insists that we put in boundaries and borders. He says, first of all, don't think that steps in the Beit HaMikdash necessarily told you where the Kedusha started or ended, and therefore that wouldn't qualify as a good border. He also said, in response to the Chazon Ish, that he doesn't think there's any naming requirement in terms of the areas of sanctity within the Beit HaMikdash. And his basic answer is that he thinks that just because something is called a different area, for the Rambam, that was enough to require a boundary to show you're now entering a different area. Okay, the next piece that he discusses is the Rambam in Halacha Yud Aleph, in that same first chapter of Hilchot Beit HaBechira, where Rav Kagan had questioned the fact that the Rambam says, "Umitzvah min amuchat mufchar." Now I'm quoting an excerpted Rambam from Beit HaBechira Aleph Yud Aleph 1:11. It's a mitzvah min amuchar lechazik habinyan, to strengthen the structure of the Beit HaMikdash and to make it as high as people can make it, as that community can make it, as the verse says, "Ulerumeim et Beit Elokeinu," to exalt the house of our Lord with farinoto, and you make it as beautiful, umiapin, and you make it and you decorate it kefikochan as much as they're able to. If they can do it with gold and make it even more wondrous, that's a mitzvah. So that's the way the Rambam says it. So on its face, it seems like a reasonable principle, right? As generation comes to build the Beit HaMikdash, something for us to think about, God willing, in the future, when the time comes that we are able to build the Beit HaMikdash, we're supposed to be putting into it the best architectural skill that we have and the best materials that we can use and the most fancy and the beautiful and all that. That, by the way, to me is an interesting question. Everyone takes for granted, for example, the gold buildings or buildings that are built, and are more beautiful than. I think that's an interesting thing to think about. But whatever it would be, right? And elsewhere, not in this realm, but he talks about the floor of the Azara, of the courtyard, should be in the most precious stones they can find, right? It's supposed to be as beautiful as possible. All that makes sense, except that Rabbi Kagan points out that Kol Tzirat HaBinyan, the whole structure, the whole way that you build a Beit HaMikdash, is supposed to be guided by a Navi, by a prophet. And it seems like Psukim in Tanakh say, HaKol Bichtav, it was all in writing from the prophet of Chol HaMidot, and with all of the proportions. So that sounds like, and it says you're not supposed to add to it, you're not supposed to take away from it. So what does it mean to be magbiho, to lift it as much as you can? So that's an interesting question, right? If the Navi of whatever generation is going to build a Beit HaMikdash, is going to give you exact directions, then what's the whole idea? You should do it as best as you can. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, that's an excellent question. And he thinks it's an excellent question that nobody, it's a wonder to him that nobody has raised before. And because of the question, he says he's going to give an answer. So his answer, again, is his logical understanding based on the fact that he's got this problem, and he's going to come to a logical answer. I think it's interesting to me to think about in this case that the answer that he's going to give is going to be one that might tell us that the Navi doesn't do it as exactly as it sounds like, right? A kol bichtav, it's all written, it might mean the Navi gives you... Anyway, we'll see his answer. His answer is that this chapter, he thinks he's talking about Din Torah. Mashu la'akev u'ma la'mitzvah. That it's telling you the basic Torah requirements, what is absolutely necessary, and without it, you don't have a Beit HaMikdash, it doesn't qualify as a Beit HaMikdash, and what is a mitzvah, what is the best idea that you can, and therefore, in Halakha Hey, he told you in this chapter, he told you things that are ikar b'binyan, that are absolutely necessary for the binyan, and there are only three of them. You need, for the structure of the Beit HaMikdash, you need a kodesh, a room where the menorah and the aron, and the, not the aron, the menorah and the shulchan, the table and the mizbeach, and the incense, the golden altar, as it's called, for incense, are a Kodesh Kodashim, a sanctified room beyond that where you could have had an Aron Kodesh, and an Ulam, and an entry vestibule, I think the word is used in English, an entryway into that building. And that's all that's required as a base requirement for the structure Al Pi Din Torah. Even though, if a Navi came along, the Navi told them, as they did in the first Beit HaMikdash and the second Beit HaMikdash, you could build attics and offices in the attic and places up there to use for various kinds of things. And then you couldn't change from that because you have to, shetzarich l'kayeh divrei Navi, because when a Navi tells you a halacha, you have to follow the halacha of the Navi. So what's the purpose of the Navi if the Beit HaMikdash has a Torah structure? The answer is the Torah structure is sort of a minimum. That minimum can't be gone beyond, can't be ignored, can't be left behind. But then the Navi has the ability and is supposed to, in every case of every community, tell them beyond that. So Rav Moshe Feinstein suggests that it's the Din Torah that each community should build it as high as they can, as beautifully as they can, and all these kinds of things. But then the halacha of the Navi would be that they have to, that they can't do anything different than the Navi tells them to do. So once the Navi told them, for example, the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, they can't, that they need to build it 60 amot high, which is what it was, and the second Beit HaMikdash was like 100 amot high. He says, once the Navi tells you that, and then you can't do any less than that, even though you could have gotten all the way less than that by Din Torah, but the Navi told you more. Slightly a bit of a problem, because once the Navi tells you a thing, you not only can't you do less, you can't do more. That's what Moshe Feinstein says, because you have the Navi telling it to you, even though that seems to contradict the mitzvah min amufkar min haTorah, because the Torah, the way the Rav Moshe Feinstein is reading it, is that the mitzvah min amufkar, the best mitzvah, is to do it as high as you possibly can. But then it comes along and says, nope, 60 amot. So theoretically, I could have said, maybe the Navi tells me the amount this community is able to do. But if they come along and they say, you know what, Navi, we can do more, and the Navi had already said it, that would be a problem for his reading. But that's his reading. His reading is that on a Torah level, the Torah is telling us, do it as best you can. And the Navi comes along and defines for us what we're going to do in this particular generation. So once I'm going to have a Navi in every generation, why do I care about it? Why is there a Din Torah? So Moshe Feinstein says, well, there's two reasons. First of all, that the Din Torah is kavua le'olam. It's there forever. So kavua le'olam, this is an important point, I think, that extends to issues like of derabbanan as well. It's important to know, I think Moshe Feinstein is telling you, it's important to know, just in general, in terms of understanding halacha and Torah and what Hashem wants of us, it's important to know that which is eternal, timeless, and universal. First, I remember the teacher tried to get me to appreciate literature. One of the things they always said was that great literature is timeless and universal. So aspects of halacha that are d'oraita are timeless and universal. That's a din ha-kavua le'olam. So the aspects of the Beit HaMikdash that have been set up by Din Torah are timeless and universal, whereas every generation's Navi who's going to tell them how to build their Beit HaMikdash in their time, so he says that's more like a hora'at shah. It's almost like, you know, rabbis coming along as they can in other areas of halacha and saying, even though halacha is this way, for now we're going to do this. So, and Nevi'im have that right, prophets have that right, and that's about a particular Beit HaMikdash. In addition, though, Rav Moshe Feinstein, there's also another difference. Let's suppose the Torah has halachas about how to build the Beit HaMikdash, and a Navi comes along to a generation that's building it and says, and this is what really you have to be doing, and then they build it differently from what the Navi said. So they violated the Torah. They violated the Torah seriously to transgress what a Navi tells you. And this is something that people have lost sight of, I think. Once you have a Navi, Once you have an established Navi, and how you establish a Navi is a whole topic of its own. Once you have established Navi, it is an Isser Mita. It is like a Mita B'dei Shamayim. It is you'll get death at the hands of heaven if you don't listen to a proper command of that Navi. So there's a case in Melachim where one Navi says to the other one, hit me, and the other one says, I'm not going to hit you. And he gets the death penalty B'dei Shamayim. Hashem brings his death about by virtue of the fact that he refused to listen to an authoritative Navi. So once a Navi tells you to do something, it's a very serious issue. Navi comes to you and says, it seems silly to you, right? So it doesn't matter. You don't have the right to judge. Once the person's a Navi, they say, you know, you got to cross the street right now. You have to pick up and move to Xanadu. There's no Xanadu. To South Africa right now, right? Whatever they tell you. As long as it's not a Avodah Zarah issues, you have to do it. So if you build a Beit HaMikdash in a way the Navi didn't tell you to, in ways different from what the Navi told you to, that generation will, God forbid, have violated the Torah in a very serious way. But as long as it fits the Torah standards of a Beit HaMikdash, it will be a valid Beit HaMikdash. Whereas, if you violate the Torah standards, it's not a valid Beit HaMikdash, it doesn't actually serve its function as a Beit HaMikdash. So that's where Moshe Feinstein thinks would be an important difference. That's why the Rambam would feel it appropriate to pasken both the D'oraita standards, while leaving it open to the fact that you need to have the Navi's telling you what to do in every particular Beit HaMikdash that you built. So he points out that even though the Mizbeach, for example, the one in the Azara, not the one in the Kodesh, in the building itself, the one that we were talking about before, so even though it has to be no less than the one built in the desert, you see in the first Beit HaMikdash was 28 by 28 Amas, so that's before when I was saying I forgot how much it was. So that area beyond the Ezra Kohanim was 28 Amma wide, that situation. The Beit HaMikdash, second, there was the 32 Amot, which is, you know, somewhere in the area of 48 to 64 feet, right? So it's a very pretty big area, and you can't add or take away from that. That's based on the Navi, but let's say they did. So again, they would be liable, and that would be terrible, but they would, it would be a valid Mizbeach having been built as long as it met the minimum Torah standards for building a Beit HaMikdash. Sorry, for building a Mizbeach. So then that, he suggests, would be the answer here too, that in the Torah law, any height is okay, and the mitzvah is to build it as high as you can, and there's no limit, but then you're going to have to listen to your Navi at your time. So we're running out of time, there's a little bit more in this tshuva, but I'm going to have to skip the rest just because I don't want to take up too much of your time. But that point, before, I don't want to leave that point in the middle, because I think it's important to think about, because I think the point about a minimum is interesting and is valid and makes sense, but then when the Rambam writes that you have to be miromeim, you have to make it as high as possible, that's a halacha that I don't understand how it makes any sense. When you tell me that the Torah sets out minima, and then the Navi tells you beyond that what you should do, it makes sense. But if the Torah's going to say, do the best you can, whatever you can, then the role of the Navi becomes much more unclear. So it's not my place in these respond in these shiurim to give my own answers necessarily. So I'm not going to, and I'm over time, so I don't want to do it too much. But I think that it might be the Navi won't necessarily give that exact, maybe the phrase of a kol b'ktav was all in writing, wasn't quite as exact as all that either. It might have left room for them to do what they could do. Meaning, when the Navi came along, did the Navi say, it must be this much? Or did he say, it must be at least this much? Did he say, you must use these materials? So, I don't know, I think that would be an interesting question to think about, but it's not for now. Our topic today, though, was Moshe Feinstein's response from the 20th of Iyar of Tavshin Chav Zayin of 1967. Remarkably, to me, prefiguring the quick conquest of Har HaBayit that came soon after. This is May 30th, and it came, you know, in early June. This is from Shut Igret Moshe Kotcher Mitaros Kodek Bet Aleph from 20th Iyar, responsible day, with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Ramitz, David Hochhauser. Have a great day.